WBEZ is supported by Impact Grants Chicago. Over 400 women come together in a unique model of collective giving. Each member contributes $1,000, and together those donations grow into $100,000 grants for Chicago nonprofits that address critical challenges across the city. By pooling resources, individual gifts multiply into greater impact. Listeners can learn more about Impact Grants Chicago and past grant recipients at impactgrantschicago.org/join2025. WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
We made it to Friday, and that means it's time to look back at the biggest stories of the week in our weekly news recap. I'm Susie Ahn, in for Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset.
I never could have imagined that I'd be taking on the richest man in the world. And we won!
Suburban voters have weighed in on local leadership. In South Suburban Dalton, Jason House is the winner.
And a Democratic-backed candidate for Aurora mayor defeated incumbent Republican Richard Irvin.
The Chicago Teachers Union's contract deal has been approved by a governing body of elected representatives from each school.
We don't want this to be a contract. We want this to catalyze a different way of doing the work.
These are just a few of the stories we'll be getting to today. And of course, we couldn't do it alone. On the panel today was Kate Grossman, assistant managing editor for WBEZ, Ravi Beshwal, anchor of ABC7's 5 and 6 p.m. newscasts, and David Greising, the president of the Better Government Association. Now, I know tariffs are dominating the headlines this week, and we'll get to that. But first, we got to talk about what's happening here in our area. Suburban residents took to the polls and voted on local leaders and referenda. Ravi starts us off in Evanston.
Well, it was quite a race. You would be surprised what the kind of turnout was. Daniel Biss was the incumbent, and unofficially, he won about 60% of the vote over a spirited contest with Jeff Barini, who was also part of a new group, if you will, that was opposing some of the more bigger strategic directions that Daniel Biss was trying to take Evanston through. There's this whole effort called Envision Evanston. It's a multiple year plan till 2045. And a lot of people had some problems with that, thought it was a little too developer centric, thought it was maybe a little too big city. But a lot of people supported as well. And, you know, I want to be very clear. I actually live there in Evanston. So I should declare the fact that I actually live within 1,000 feet of the stadium. And some of those old issues around what to do with the stadium, how is the stadium going to affect neighborhoods, what to do about downtown Evanston and the fact that it hasn't really recovered much from COVID and so on. Some of those old fights came back in, and Daniel Biss apparently has got a mandate to continue with this Envision Evanston prospect, which means that I think Evanston's going to give Winnetka and Wilmette a run for its money in terms of new restaurants. So we'll see. So that was actually a little surprising how much support there was.
Yeah. And then that will be on deck for this upcoming term here. Just want to mention incumbent Martin Maloney also won another term as mayor of Northwest Suburban Park Ridge. Ravi, let's head down to the south suburb of Dalton. They've got a new mayor over there, Jason House.
Jason House, talk about a mandate, right, folks? I mean, I think he won 95%
yes.
of the vote, of course, over his... I can't even remember the name of his opponent, but his opponent in the primary, of course, was Tiffany Henyard. And he won that primary back in February by a similar margin. So people in Dalton are clearly looking to turn the page on what has been a very tumultuous time in power for Tiffany Henyard. She was there with trying to get people to write her in as a candidate, as a Thornton Township supervisor. She lost on that as well. Somehow, I don't think we've seen the last of Tiffany Henyard. I'm not entirely sure, but she seems to be good at the self-promotion part of things. And let's face it, we nearly, at ABC News, we nearly had a bureau in Dalton. My pal Eric Hong was down there every night for those very very dynamic democratic events about how public business was being conducted down there. So I think that captured the fascination of a lot of people in the Chicago area. So they're trying to turn a new leaf, have a little more of a stable local government. We'll see. Jason House promising new development, looking for multiple use housing, and bringing businesses back to Dalton.
All right. Well, let's head out west to Aurora. David, there's a new mayor over there too.
Yes, there is, and we've seen quite a fall from the outgoing mayor, Richard Irvin. Not long ago, he was running for governor with the backing of the Illinois then richest resident, Ken Griffin, the billionaire who founded a trading company, and he's voted out. John Leish, a council member, beat him. I think there was some... Once Richard Irvin lost that race, there was a feeling, and he lost, let's not forget, in the primary. Mm-hmm. He didn't even make it to the general election despite the backing of Ken Griffin. The people of Aurora kind of seemed to think that he kind of took his eye off the ball and really wasn't focused on the needs of that community, which are substantial. During his tenure, he got a lot of economic development going in the downtown area of Aurora. It's now the second largest city in the state of Illinois. He gets some credit for that, but apparently voters felt they needed a change, and partly because of the distraction and the loss that he could never quite completely shake.
Right. And I mean, you mentioned the 2022 candidate for governor there. I mean, were you surprised with that type of name recognition? Also, just being an incumbent that he lost this.
Yes and no. If you followed the election, it did seem that he was weaker than one might have expected, given the track record that he had built to the point that Ken Griffin selected him to take on J.B. Pritzker. But if you followed sort of that post-election period, he's been criticized for a lack of attention to what was going on. And so I guess it wasn't that surprising. And Leish, I think, ran a good campaign against him as well.
Well, Democrats took control from Republicans in dozens of township elections. That includes Addison Township, home to past U.S. Representative Henry Hyde and former Illinois Senate President James Pate Phillip. David, help us make sense of these Republican losses here.
Well, Illinois is becoming a monochromatic blue state in a lot of senses, especially up here in northeastern Illinois. If you go south of I-80, it's a completely different picture. But the Democratic Party of Illinois backed 280 different candidates in this election, and 222 of them won. That's a 79% victory rate. And so part of this is just reflecting a governor who I think is quite influential and on the political side is spreading money around, and that certainly is helping. And also a sense, I think, among voters that the Republican Party just doesn't really have an identity in Illinois right now, certainly not one that that people can sign on for and think that a Republican in office is going to be helpful to them. Even if they may not particularly appreciate all of the liberal politics of the Democrats who are running, the best chance of getting something done is, in the view of voters, it seems, is to have a Democrat in office, just because of all the alliances they'll have in state. The Republican Party is really in a weak state right now and recognizes that they need to kind of start by fixing their own house before they can start really seriously competing in local offices, much less statewide.
Yeah.
Can I just make one quick point? When you talk about Richard Irvin losing in Aurora, partially because he took his eye off the ball of what's happening in Aurora, that, just as a quick aside, was a big issue in Evanston as well. A lot of people thinking that Daniel Biss had his eye on the next the next office up. And of course, that's the 9th district, Jan Schakowsky. She's been around for 20 years. What's going to happen with that? And I think that one of the reasons Biss did actually win was because he did recognize that he was a little bit vulnerable on that question. And so so folks really are tuned in from there to Dalton to Aurora about what is happening in their community and how democracy is unfolding wherever they live.
And didn't Biss commit not to seek another office during this current term, which was a surprise to a lot of people?
It really was. Yeah. And we'll see what the Democratic Party of Illinois thinks about that. I mean, minds can be switched, but that is that was a very big promise by him.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I want to head over to Wisconsin, where Democrats also prevailed there. They chose the liberal candidate for the state Supreme Court. Kate, put that election in perspective for us.
Sure. So there was a huge, huge national spotlight on this judicial race in Wisconsin for a number of reasons. So this court in Wisconsin, the Supreme Court in Wisconsin, will, of course, have influence over, you know, this is a battleground state. So they'll have influence in the midterm election and, of course, the 2028 election. They have really key cases in front of them. Abortion is critical. Redistricting. They have a case. They'll be looking at a case about public employees and their bargaining rights. So because of those issues, the money and the interest is poured in, and the biggest money guy of all came pouring in, which of course we all know is Elon Musk. So he came in rip roaring with his cheese hat. And it did not fly. The cheese heads did not go for Elon Musk. I think, he just threw his money around. I mean, he gave away, three checks for $1 million to voters. He, said to people, if you sign my petition, I'll give you $100. I'll give you another $100 if you refer people. And, the winner, the Democrat who won Crawford, she really made that an issue about buying democracy. And that is not the way we do things in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that wasn't the only issue, of course. Wisconsin voters were, considering a lot of things. But that just really backfired in Wisconsin.
But again, back to this idea of local democracy, people felt an affront, I think, at some level. And I think that Elon Musk became a weather vane in that regard. And people didn't like his money coming in. They didn't like his showboating, his style and all the rest of it. But it also made them feel at some level of analysis I've read and talking to people that their democracy locally was being pulled away from them. They're losing control. And it'll be very interesting to see what that means for the nation as we eventually hit this next midterm season of elections.
And I think it's interesting, too, because Wisconsin is not Evanston.
Yeah.
it's a battleground state, right? We have Republicans and Democrats. It's very mixed. And so it's people did not like someone from out of town coming in and telling them how to vote.
It's very mixed, and it also has one of the most gerrymandered electoral maps in the country. And that was one of the key issues at stake here, because the Supreme Court has basically said they're not going to make any rulings on political gerrymandering. It's up to the states. And so that as much as anything is, I think, what was hanging in the balance in this election.
Absolutely. So while Judge Susan Crawford won that election, as we mentioned, of course, Elon Musk was by far the biggest single donor in that election. Democrats actually contributed more than Republicans. Kate, that also included our own governor.
Yeah, I guess J.B. Pritzker donated $1.5 million, I understand, from the reporting from AP that I read. So he was all in there. The Democratic Party that Dave spoke about, they've sent a lot of people over to canvass. It's right across the border, very easy for folks from Illinois. As you were talking about, this is such a blue state. the die is cast here, so a lot of people want to get up to Wisconsin and try to sway things. And we all have read lots of stories and covered. J.B. Pritzker obviously has higher ambitions, and so getting involved, I mean, this is a neighboring state. It means a lot to him and his
But it fits.
Interest in Illinois.
It fits the narrative at the lower level and for the future. It's like a block. It's a twofer. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the Democratic Party of Illinois sent many, many people up for the presidential election and still lost the state. So it is interesting that this time around, maybe they learned something from the last go-around in November. But the result obviously was quite different.
I want to now turn to Chicago Public Schools. The contract deal between the teachers union and CPS continues to move forward. Kate, what are some of the main elements in this four-year deal?
So some of the top line, so it's a four-year deal. We're actually coming up at the end of the first year because it took such a long time to come to terms. But it's a four-year deal. It's cost $1.5 billion. For the members, the 30,000 members, it's 4% raises in the first year and up to 5% raises in the years after. In addition to they get some other raises too for experience. So it's, you know, pretty generous raises. The class size limits were lowered. You know, and that activates if they go above that, you get a teacher assistant, or maybe you split the class size in half, something to alleviate the overcrowding. New librarians, that's been a big issue. Most CPS schools do not have librarians. You know, small numbers of, you know, bilingual teaching assistants, tech coordinators, extra pay for veteran teachers. So in a lot of different areas, not huge gains, but a lot of different areas. The teachers union got some victories.
I thought it was interesting that there was the guarantee for teachers to have academic freedom to teach as well.
Right. Although, you know, let's just break that down a little bit, because actually what they wanted was so right now the principal has the final say about what is taught in the classroom, and that remains. That they did not succeed in changing that, but they can have say over supplemental material in the classroom. So that was actually more of a victory for CPS. They held firm in that area, but they did get the right to, you know, have control of their supplemental material.
Well, the raises are the same offer teachers had on the table last summer. I mean, obviously, teachers are voting in favor for this, but in general, do they seem to say that the conflict of the last year was worth it?
Well, yeah, I mean, these raises were, as you said, on the table last summer, and yet the negotiations went on for all this time. I think the reason why, so this was the first contract negotiations under sort of a new set of terms. The teachers union had expanded bargaining rights historically, or for the last, I can't remember, a decade or more, they've been restricted to only bargaining about sort of bread and butter, salary and benefits. They often did roundabout ways to try to bargain about other things, but now they are legally allowed to bargain over all these things that I just talked about, class size and academic freedom. And so that was really important to the teachers union, and that's why the negotiations went on for so long. Preparation time for elementary school teachers, all these things, that's why they went on for so long. And I think if you ask, you know, your average teacher, these things matter. This is about their experience in the classroom. So, you know, I certainly haven't polled all the teachers out there, but, you know, it matters.
Was it also a little bit of a flex by the CTU to stretch this out in the name of the union that they wanted to have under Karen Lewis, the late Karen Lewis, the former leader, to be a little bit more militant, to be a little bit more kind of engaging on these more gray areas beyond the bread and butter, and that they had like a vested institutional interest for their own sake, especially with a mayor who was clearly someone who was sympathetic to their cause, to show the kind of power that the CTU has for now and for the future?
I think so. And I think a big part of it was the mayor, right? I mean, the mayor, this is his signature. This is in his heart. This is the issue that matters most. He wants to transform the school system. I don't think the CTU says this is a transformational contract. I think it makes a lot of changes in a bunch of areas. I don't think it's going to transform the school experience for your average kid. I think it's going to make some nice changes, hopefully, as they come into play. But I think that's the main thing. They had their ally in City Hall. They were not going to give in on a bunch of these core issues.
And also their ability to flex, as Ravi puts it, was limited because they weren't going to go out on strike on a mayor whom they put into office and on whom they're relying for so much. And that's why some of these other issues became so important, not to mention the fact that they also turned school CEO Pedro Martinez himself into an issue and ultimately did get him fired, but didn't solve the underlying problems that led to his firing, specifically the mayor's insistence that he borrow $300 million to cover a $175 million pension payment that's coming due, not to mention the cost of this contract. And so they did have kind of a mixed result here. But some of the changes that are coming, the community-centered schools, I think the contract will allow adding 50 to the existing 20. That's a big deal.
Yeah.
And partly because there's a moratorium on new school closings. And a big question about, okay, there's a bunch of schools that you can't really justify the fact that the doors are still open. And if the CPS and the city are successful in turning these into real community centers, it becomes more justifiable. Otherwise, when 2027, when the moratorium expires, we might see a huge number of school closings after that.
I also think because the CPS really held firm on the finances. You know, I mean, this is an expensive contract, but it's not, CTU came in, you know, CPS says it was a $10 billion. I don't know if that's the exact number, but it was, you know, they had very high asks. And CPS did hold firm. Most of the things that I've discussed aren't big money items, but they're about the classroom experience.
Well, I want to we got to get to a break in just a second, but I want to get this in here before we do. Yesterday, the Trump administration threatened to withhold federal funding from schools until they prove they've eliminated all diversity programs. Kate, can you fill us in on those details?
Sure. So this is the latest effort by the Trump administration to go after diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. And this specifically is, they're saying they would withhold Title I money, which is money that comes to states and then goes to school districts for low-income students. And in essence, what they're saying is school districts have 10 days to certify that they have no DEI programs, or else they're going to lose federal funding. Now, of course, I'm sure there's going to be a suit. I'm sure it's probably going to be blocked. And the definition of what a DEI program is unclear.
That is correct. Education Secretary Linda McMahon even said that, yes, celebrating MLK Day seems to be okay, but Black History Month was still a question for her.
Yeah.
Well, Governor Pritzker just got back from spending several days in Mexico. This was not a spring break vacation to Cancun, was it, David?
No, it wasn't. He and the 70-some people he brought with him were quite busy. It was a trade delegation. And sometimes people look at these things and think they're junkets. They're not, really. They really do serve a real purpose, and especially this one, which was timed perfectly for Pritzker in terms of his national profile, because he was down in Mexico at the moment President Trump was imposing tariffs on many of our trading partners, including Mexico. One thing that I found out about it is that normally when a governor goes on a big trade trip like this, they come back with at least one or two sort of big new deals that are announced. And all that was announced really was an intent to cooperate, to ease trade barriers, to talk in the future, et cetera. The governor in a press call, you know, said that there were a lot of great conversations that happened down there. But there was not a specific, hey, look what we brought back with us. Mm. Nevertheless, it was noted that the timing of it, and as Governor Pritzker fashions himself as one of the lead sort of voices of anti-Trumpism, what people have been looking at for the benefit of the state of Illinois is, Governor, what are you going to do besides complain about Trump This is a concrete example of, well, I'm going to go out and try to work out trade deals that are going to be more difficult in this time of tariffs, et cetera. And so he's bringing back a concrete message, even though the delegation came back empty-handed in terms of specific deals.
Yeah, you mentioned the timing of this, which was right on. Let's hear what Governor Pritzker had to say about President Trump rolling out these massive numbers of new tariffs.
The tariffs seem so broad-based and not well negotiated or thought out that they will potentially destroy some businesses in Mexico that U.S. companies rely upon.
It's not just Mexico being hit by tariffs, of course. Canada has been one of the president's top targets, although they were excluded from yesterday's new tariffs. Ravi, as a Canadian who's spent many years working as a journalist there, I have got to put you on the hot seat. How are your fellow Canadians reacting to all of this?
Well, you know, there's a federal election going on right now, and Justin Trudeau was replaced as the prime minister by Mark Carney. And in the parliamentary system, if you become the leader of the party with the most seats in parliament, you become automatically the prime minister, even though he doesn't have a seat in the House. So you've got a federal election to have the next mandate, maybe for Mark Carney, maybe for the conservative leader, Pierre Poilievre. It seems to be a two-horse race. But I am telling you, in talking to people and reading and talking to family and so on, I have never seen Canadians more united over what to do and taking a front at these tariffs. And not just the tariffs, but sort of the abrogation of a friendship that Canadians hold very deep. Most Canadians, I think it's 85% of Canadians live within a two-hour drive of the U.S. border. Yeah. Most people have a family member who lives in the States. My sister is married to an American. I am a Canadian. I'm a dual citizen. I live here. My wife's Canadian. It's intermingled in a way that I don't think a lot of Americans really understand. But it is a distinct place, and it is completely a separate place that has much different values around, collective rights versus individual rights and so on. And people are, during this election, we're seeing a level of unity in Canada between French and English people, between urban and rural, between rich and poor, between black and white, between east and west. All the fissures that are normally there in the Canadian body politic are quite united about having to respond strongly to the United States and its tariffs, because the Canadian economy, for whatever reason over the years, is so integrated to the American economy. And a lot of people in Canada for a long time have said Canada needs to be more independent. And that whole question, that political question, is becoming central to this election, which is central to why they're fighting back with Donald Trump. And I'm just looking at on X right here, Mark Carney, the Liberal leader, the current prime minister, is saying that if the United States is unwilling to lead in a trade-based relationship with the rest of the world where everybody wins, if the U.S. is no longer wants to lead, Canada will. That's something that is a message that a lot of Canadians are going to hope Americans hear.
Absolutely. I mean, did you ever think you'd see the relationship between Canada and the U.S. so strained?
It's always a question there, but it's Justin Trudeau's father, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, who was the father essentially of modern Canada, who was the prime minister, it seems, forever through my childhood. He used to say, being Canadian is like being a mouse sleeping next to an elephant. You're always very aware of what's going on with the elephant, and you want to make sure that you're safe. But remember, elephants can get scared by mice, right? So there's that piece of the analogy. And I've just never seen this, and I think that a lot of people in Canada are very... So they're, Canadians are not, chest thumpers. They don't wave the flag the same way. The patriotism is a lot more quiet. But to see how people are coming together to sort of say, okay, what does it mean to be Canadian relative to America? What does it mean to be an independent country? What are we really standing for? How do we keep national health care? These are the kinds of questions that are existential there and are being forced to be asked and answered because of the actions of President Trump, of the actions of one person.
Absolutely. Well, other Illinois Democrats also expressed frustration with the president's new tariffs. Here's Senator Dick Durbin.
The consequences of this trade war will be painful and avoidable. Everyday Americans will feel it. If fully enacted, Trump's trade war will cause price hikes on nearly all basic goods.
David, which Illinois industries do you expect could be hit particularly hard here?
Well, there's Illinois has seen a significant increase in the auto industry, and the auto industry with Canada is so integrated, and parts go back and forth as an auto is assembled, et cetera. And so that's going to be a big area. The other one not to be overlooked is farm. Mm. The farm economy is really sort of on the line right now. And the retaliatory tariffs from other countries are going to hit the farm sector very hard. And here up in northern Illinois, we don't think of this as a big farm state. We are a huge farm state. And so those are two that kind of stand out. The other is that we still do a fair amount of just general manufacturing, and we have many industries that do rely on parts and raw materials from other countries that now will be facing tariffs. And the exports, obviously, are going to hit Illinois manufacturers quite.
Yeah.
The tariffs on other countries impose are going to hit Illinois manufacturers quite
hard. I mean, I've heard that consumers are going to be going to buy a car in the next couple of days, trying to get ahead of those price hikes. I mean, I'll speak for myself personally. I might go stock up on shoes for my kids. Mm. Anyone personally feeling like they need to stock up on anything before?
I hate to stock up on looking in the rearview mirror about what happened to everyone's retirement accounts.
Oh, my goodness,
I'm looking
yes.
at the markets right now. I mean, if you're within 5 years of retirement, and we know here at Public Media and God bless Chicago Public Media. Can I just say as a supporter, I listen to your campaigns all the time. It's always on in our home. We're a journalism home. And I just thought, I got to give a buck a day. And Disney Corporation actually doubles that. So thank you for all of you who do the work
there
here.
There you go. Not even a pledge drive.
There's me on your pledge drive. But like looking at the markets today, the Dow Jones is down 4.25%. The NASDAQ is down 5%. This is going to affect people, for, you know, yes, shoes, but it's people's futures are on the line here, which makes me think so much of this has got to be understood in the White House as negotiation tactics. And you're going to go into these various countries now and start to make deals to bring those tariff walls down. Because the real world impact, as Dick Durbin just said, is fantastical. It's look at everything in your house. Everything is going to cost more, including the house.
Things happen faster today than they have historically just because everything moves faster with technology, et cetera. But when you start a trade war with tariffs, it takes a long time for the measures and countermeasures, the retaliation, et cetera, to play out. And maybe things go faster, but this could be with us for years. Mm. And we've seen the global economy really grind to a halt during past trade wars. And we're at the start of one, and I think it's fair to say we've started it.
I'm going to be working for the next couple of years longer than I thought I might have to. And I think a lot of people are going to be making those kinds of baseline decisions. And just as back to J.B. Pritzker, he said yesterday on MSNBC, this is what Herbert Hoover did that really made the Depression that much worse and made it carry on a lot longer. Things mm-hmm. do happen faster now. And of course, the White House is saying, you know, you've got to let there's a mandate here. You've got to allow us to put these policies forward and see, give us some time and see if it works. That old line in economics, right? In the short term, yeah, there's going to be a lot of pain, but all economics is about, what about the long term? Well, in the long term, we're all dead. So there's that part of it as well.
But the argument is that in the long term, the Trump hope is that this will bring manufacturing and back onto our shores. That's the aspiration,
right.
which is quite expensive and takes a long time.
To David's point, it takes a long time for the tariffs to set in to make those business investments in a stable environment and then to start to see the fruit of that.
Well, plenty to say about tariffs, but we're going to turn now to higher ed. We've got a couple of stories involving local universities. Let's start with Northwestern, which is being targeted by another congressional investigation. Kate, what are the details?
So this Republican committee is, again, looking at Northwestern. It's the same committee that called them to look at around anti-Semitism. And they sent a letter at the end of March to look at all the legal clinics that they have at the law school. There's more than 20 of them. And they said in the letter that they are there are indications that these legal clinics are engaging in, quote, progressive left political advocacy. And they cited a bunch of cases in these letters, and it's very invasive, this investigation. They want the names of donors. They want their budgets. They want the personnel files specifically of one of the lead, you know, the one of the women who runs one of the clinics. You know, people are saying that this is, you know, unlikely to get all the files, but just to have a tremendous chilling effect. I mean, what kind of donor is going to want to donate when their name is going to be at risk? The university is already retrenching. You know, there's budget cuts all over the place because there's so much uncertainty about what's going to happen because the NIH funding is being cut and the diversity, mm-hmm. equity, all these things. And so there's so much retrenchment, financial retrenchment at universities. Mm-hmm. And this is just another method of that. And this, so that these clinics, which are, you know, another point is that this is a way for students to learn how to do this kind of legal advocacy, this potential loss of that opportunity. So not just at Northwestern, of course, but legal clinics, a lot of law schools have these. Yeah.
How has the university responded to this?
So they're, of course, defending the clinics and saying that these are not left-wing, that they represent people, you know, these are nonpartisan, they represent people, you know, of all political persuasions, and that they're defending them, though they would not say one way or the other whether they intend to comply with the request for all this information.
I want to turn now to DePaul. Two Jewish students who were attacked last fall on the campus have sued the university. Kate, what are the details there?
So according to the Sun-Times story that Mary Norkel wrote, so in November, there were two young Jewish men who were expressing their support for Israel on campus in front of the student center. And police say they were attacked by two men wearing black masks. One of them had a concussion, one had a broken wrist, and now they are suing. They're saying that DePaul was negligent, that failed to protect them. Apparently, DePaul had canceled, according to the suit, a security contract. You know, this was, if people remember, of course, this was, there were all the protests on campus. DePaul had a very, you know, robust encampment. So they, in the suit, they're saying essentially that DePaul should have known there was a threat to Jewish students and they didn't do enough to protect them.
And of course, I'm assuming the university is defending themselves.
Of course. They're saying that at the time they condemned this attack as anti-Semitic and that they're working with the police and that this defies the values of the university and the dignity of every individual.
I mean, where that assault happened was right in the middle of the front door of the campus. And it was quite blatant, and there was some subterfuge going on where the one guy who was the Jewish student who was trying to build a conversation on campus about what was going on in Israel and in the Gaza Strip was basically distracted by a conversation so that another guy could assault him from behind. And this happened, and those are fairly serious injuries. So it'll be interesting to see how the fact profile comes out for how they defend themselves at the university.
And we have to head to a break in just a sec, but I wanted to squeeze this last piece of news in. Mayor Brandon Johnson named who he wants to succeed 35th Ward Alderman Carlos Ramirez Rosa. Who has he picked, David?
Well, he's picked Anthony Cozada, who at one point worked for Carlos Ramirez Rosa. He is cut from very much the same political cloth. Carlos Ramirez Rosa, your listeners might recall, is now running the Chicago Park District, which is a very important job. And Brandon Johnson was pretty upfront about all this. He said, essentially, I think that Ramirez Rosa represented this ward very well. And here's a person just like the old person. There was some criticism because the mayor did go through the motions of having some interviews for people who might be interested in the job, not directly with the mayor, but with a small panel of people. And some of those who were not appointed have complained that it was kind of a fixed game. I guess, welcome to Chicago.
Who sent you? It's a classic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who sent you?
Yeah. So in terms of the mayor's support in council, this means he's got another loyal supporter in a city council that is not necessarily supporting him on many of his initiatives. And so, sure, this will get him one more vote, but he's got it doesn't fix his broader problem with this city council.
We'll turn now to the Streeterville neighborhood. We have two different stories involving 15-year-olds and guns. First, a 15-year-old has been charged with the shooting of a tourist near the AMC movie theater 3 weeks ago. Then last Friday night, a 15-year-old was shot during a teen gathering in the same neighborhood. Here's how 2nd Ward Alderman Brian Hopkins described what happened.
They were blocking traffic, jumping on cars, harassing pedestrians, stealing from the stores. There were several fights. Tasers were deployed.
Kate, at least a dozen people were reportedly arrested from that event. Alderman Hopkins is calling for the teen curfew to be lowered from the current 10 p.m. to 8 p.m. How likely is that to happen?
Well, this is always a very contentious topic, teen curfew. So the mayor has already come out against lowering the curfew. He argues that that will simply move kids from Streeterville to other neighborhoods, and that the real answer is to find opportunities to engage kids in more productive activities. So, you know, as we were just discussing, you know, the mayor doesn't necessarily have as much juice as he might want, but this is always a very fraught topic. I mean, every summer this comes up. There's a struggle around kids come downtown. You want kids to enjoy themselves and to be able to gather, and a lot of kids are in neighborhoods where they can't do that, and there aren't opportunities, and it's a struggle to figure out what to do. So the mayor is opposed, and I'm sure there's lots of other people on city council. So this is not a shoo-in by any means.
I think this is one of those issues, though, where the mayor's political capital is easily earned and lost. And if he's earned some political capital over his position and his effectiveness, I guess, in getting the CTU contract, which I think he has earned some political capital there to get that deal done, I think that the political people around him need to be very aware of what this really feels like on the ground. I can say from not personal experience, but my very good friend who actually does live in the Streeterville neighborhood and his wife, and he's owns a couple of restaurants and fast food places, and I should put the plug in, Bombay Eats. Check it out. Anyway, there you go. The fact is they got caught up in the middle of all this, and they are total downtown people. They live in the high-rise. They like the urban edge of living downtown. But to sort of judge how they were so taken aback by what happened in that one Streeterville incident, and it's not the first one, and it's obviously not the last one, and they're very progressive people, but they're kind of saying, like, the mayor's response just doesn't, it doesn't hit. It doesn't hit with them. It doesn't go to their quote unquote lived experience.
Absolutely. Well, I want to turn now from we've been talking about our current mayor to a former mayor. David, Rahm Emanuel's up to something new now.
Something new that's something old for him. He's back in the deal business. He's at a firm called Centerview Partners, where he previously worked before he was mayor, and he, you know, he's gone in and out of investment banking during the course of his career. He worked at a firm, Wasserstein Perella. He did some major deals. He was involved in the deal that led to the creation of Exelon, the company that owns Commonwealth Edison. He did some deals with Bruce Rauner. People might remember a photograph of he and Bruce Rauner at Rauner's Montana Ranch, and that emerged out of a friendship. And there was some hope.
Was the wine that they were drinking?
Exactly. Yeah, there was some hope at that point. There was a friendship there that the two of them could trade off of when Rauner was governor. That didn't go very well. But everybody knows that Rahm probably doesn't necessarily need a steady income, but he's got to keep himself busy while he plans whatever comes next. And that's really what people are paying attention to with regard to Rahm Emanuel. What he said very clearly, he's not done with public service. People are wondering if he's going to run for governor, if J.B. Pritzker runs for president, or might he run for president? And it's not without question that he might even decide to run for mayor of Chicago again. So the real guessing game is about that. Nice to know he's got a steady paycheck. paycheck coming in again.
I mean, you mentioned the not done with public office part. I mean, David, you head up the Better Government Association. I have to ask your thoughts on people like Emanuel moving between public office and lucrative private jobs, often involving lobbying. How do you think this impacts our government?
Well, people do need to work, and I think everybody knows what if people are asked to vote for Rahm Emanuel again, they know exactly what they're getting. And we've seen plenty of people who've had very successful careers in private business. J.B. Pritzker is a good example. Yes, he was born to substantial wealth, but he was a pretty serious business person. Now that he's in elected office, he's a pretty serious governor. So we've seen plenty of people coming from the private sector and be successful in government. The revolving door part that you're talking about is a little bit different. They tend to serve in elected office, and then if they are done serving, they don't typically dip in and out. Rahm is dipping in and out, which is interesting and potentially creates some conflicts. But everybody knows he's a political animal, and I think his political interests are pretty clear.
Politicians like that, though, have a specific responsibility to talk about the values that they're going to use to make decisions in public life. And so if Rahm Emanuel does come for another round, I'll be very interested to hear what are the values that he has that have developed with all these experiences, both in the private sector, public sector. And if he can make the case, then he should not be discounted or at least disqualified from further public service. If in fact, that's what he wants. That's Absolutely. What Thomas Jefferson wanted all of us to be part of, this living democracy.
Yeah. Well, we just have just a couple of minutes left here. Wanted to get this in. Kate, Illinois is the first state to mandate that public schools offer halal and kosher meal options. Tell us about the Faith by Plate Act the governor signed into law.
Well, sure. So it's, we didn't cover it. It's a Courtney Tribbs story. So this, as you said, it's the first state to require schools and any state facility to have halal and food options, which, you know, is really very cool because for a lot of kids, you know, they go to the cafeteria line and they walk past the pizza and they walk past all the good stuff and then they get like the dregs, basically, and it's tough. And so this mandates schools to, if it's requested for kids to get that. So it's within a year. There's a caveat. The sponsor said that it's, you know, it's, there's cost to it. And so it has to be allowed, you know, has to be appropriated in the state budget. So hopefully that'll happen. But, you know, CBS already has this. So there's some models out there for how to do it. So so it's a nice development for kids to make sure everyone feels included.
And I just want to get in a couple of other headlines for drivers. A quick warning, 16 new speed enforcement cameras went into operation this week, so be aware of that. But good news for drivers, Chicagoans with ticket debt from 2023 or earlier can have their late fees waived if they pay off the fines by June 30th. Mark your calendars. Well, that will have to do it for the weekly news recap. My thanks to WBEZ's Kate Grossman, the Better Government Association's David Greising, and Ravi Beshwal of ABC7. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Susie.
This episode of the Reset podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman. It was edited and mixed by Meha Ahmed. Every Friday, Reset brings you the news you need to know in under an hour. If you want more Reset throughout the week, sign up for our newsletter. It comes out on Mondays and Fridays, and you can subscribe at wbez.org/reset. I'm Susie Yon, in for Sasha Ann Simons. Have a good weekend, and thanks for listening.
I love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or like, I have another question. Or like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.